Argue, argue, talk, 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 exaggerate, argue, pontificate, argue, just talk, shut talk, talk. Why won't you listen? Argue, why won't you see? I know the story, just listen to me.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
Hello, everybody. My name is Michael Sabbath. I am hosting for my dear friend, Karen Cataline, who's taken a few weeks off, in part to celebrate her forthcoming marriage. Let's all wish her very, very well. I've known Karen for many years. I admire her, consider her a good friend, a smart friend. And I feel honored that Karen's asked me to sit in for her. And I know it's going to be a challenge for me. I've not done this very much. I'll start out, I'll tell you something. I'm not in a particularly great mood right now. Sorry to say, I learned just yesterday that a very, very dear friend has been diagnosed with some kind of a brain trauma and is going to be undergoing surgery. I received a text from her just yesterday, kind of wishing me goodbye, saying it was lovely to know me if things don't turn out well. It's a hell of a way to begin an interview or a program, but these kinds of things are on my mind, I'll tell you. The years are going by, and perhaps some, if not many, in the audience can identify with that. So I wish my friend well, and I hope that all of you might say a prayer for her. A lovely, lovely lady. So today I've got I have a collection of topics, no particular sequence, and I hope you find them interesting. And Mr. Producer, Doug has given me a phone number. You can call in and share your thoughts or condemn my thoughts, whatever you desire. Phone number is 888-627-6008. I'll repeat it again. And later, and you call it, we can have a discussion. One thing that was on my mind, I saw another posting about somebody with either a Make America Great hat or a Trump hat or a T-shirt getting intimidated, harassed, beaten up. And this kind of thing affects me on many levels. I wonder how it affects folks in the audience. What's particularly problematic, at least to me, is the breakdown of law, the breakdown of order, that thin, delicate veneer of society being ripped away. And it's encouraged because there are no consequences. There's no consequences. There are no consequences to the violent behavior and the intimidation. The aggressor doesn't pay a price, and that's critical. And as a general proposition, if you're silent, you incur more aggression. If you're silent, you motivate and inspire more aggression. And somehow this tendency, or maybe a fascist or tyrannical tendency, is becoming more prevalent. It's percolating into the surface, up to the surface. And I foresee dire things unless we find a vehicle, unless we have the government or the police or somebody to step up and protect us. It's just a thing on my mind. It's been bugging me. How do we get protected from the thugs? The answer is I don't know. But if it continues, it's going to get worse because people will be encouraged, inspired, motivated to do more worse. Worst things. Then here's something I came across. It's kind of interesting. Something for the audience. I found it on a website. These are some conundrums. A conundrum is a puzzle, something puzzling people. So here are six. Make of it what you will. I found them kind of curious and in some way illuminating. America is a capitalist and greedy country. Yet half the population is subsidized. Half the population is subsidized, yet they think they are victims. They think they're victims, yet their representatives run the government. The representatives run the government, yet the poor don't advance very much. The poor stay the same, maybe get worse. And yet the poor have more things than most people in any other country. The average poor person, as it's defined, has a TV, has a home or apartment, has a car, has air conditioning, cell phones, and so forth. And the bizarre thing is that so many who are immigrating here, they have things that the people in other countries can only dream about, and yet they want this country to become like the other countries. So go figure. What a species, huh? The first thing I want to talk about in some depth is to me very troubling, and I think it's symptomatic of what's happening in many states in the United States. I think it's worth talking about. It's these so-called red flag laws and the issuance of what's called an ERPO, E-R-P-O, ERPO. Sounds like somebody's belching at a bar watching a football game, drinking too much beer, but that's what it's called, ERPO. And not only did Colorado have this thing passed maybe 3-4 weeks ago, but there are other states, District Columbia, Vermont, Connecticut, Illinois, Florida. There's about 12, 13 states. I want to go through this a little bit because I think that much of this law and the ones that are enacted in other states can be viewed as a metaphor beyond the thing itself, a character or an ethos. Beyond the specific legislation. And I'll talk about my thoughts on the constitutional perspective or analysis of it, but I want to go through it. I hope you don't find this too tedious or too detailed. But as an overview, this legislation is, in my opinion, misnamed, a kind of Orwellian named of emergency risk protection order, but it doesn't deal with emergencies and it does not deal with historical reality, which makes me raise the question, what is the real motivation behind this kind of legislation? In arguing against it, many of my friends, colleagues, lawyers, presented very detailed arguments about the lack of any type of impediment to criminal behavior, to dangerous behavior. The idea is good. I mean, in theory, the theoretical idea, taking away firearms from people that appear to be ready to use them to do great harm, to do great damage, is a noble and virtuous goal. But the fact is, a noble, virtuous goal does not justify incompetent, malicious, and vile legislation. We have a situation, there are some writers like Jordan Peterson, for example, who refers to the times, our times, the postmodern, post-Marxist period, where truth does not matter, facts do not matter, consequences do not matter, only power matters. And we have two brilliant people at this very prestigious Independence Institute in Denver, David Koppel, a guy with an IQ of about 7,000, and his partner, Rob Natelson, two lawyers, and they have written extensively about this proposed legislation. Well, now it's the law, written about this law. They've analyzed it 100 million different ways. And my point at this moment is the legislators know all this. They know what Natelson knows. They know what Dave Koppel knows. They know what I know. If I can figure it out, they can figure it out. An insightful line from Thomas Paine is, trying to reason with a person whose opinion is not derived from reason is like administering medicine to the dead. Okay, that's a trenchant observation. Where do we go with here? Let me take a few minutes to describe this legislation. And again, I emphasize, this isn't just Colorado. It's a third of the states almost, a quarter for sure. And it's spreading. It's spreading. In essence, the legislation permits police or citizens to begin legal proceedings to confiscate firearms from people who allegedly pose a danger to themselves or others. Now, this is a matter of confiscation, and when I explain or describe the terms of the potential confiscation, it should be chilling. It should send an electric-like shiver down the spine of any, in my opinion, a decent person. It's called an immediate emergency order, but the title is Orwellian because it doesn't in any manner deal with emergencies. It's called an emergency risk protection order, but it doesn't deal with emergencies. If I can figure that out, anybody can figure it out. The legislation has a standard of proof. It says there has to be only a significant risk of harm in the indefinite future. A person might have a firearm today and somebody can think, well, maybe in the next 200 years, he, she, they will use it in a dangerous way. That's how sloppy the legislation is crafted, but it was intended to be crafted in a sloppy manner. We lawyers talk about a burden of proof, or people should understand a burden of proof. So, for example, in a criminal case, a defendant must be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt that all the significant elements of a criminal case have been proven, each and every one, beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, it's completely different. It's just what we call a preponderance of the evidence, which means it's a coin toss. Who knows? One person can believe a little tiny bit, 50% plus a billionth part, and that's enough to go ahead with this proceeding. The person who makes the claim, and this is so important, the person who makes the claim does not have to post a bond, does not have to demonstrate any kind of details. And this is vital in its importance, is essentially immune from a fraudulent, from a false, from a misleading allegation. That means, among other things, if you're following me, I hope you are, that means that a person who can lead the police to smash down your home, smash down your doors, destroy every piece of property, couches and windows in your home, never has to pay a price, ever. Think about that. Absorb that. Okay. Now, there's a lot of talk about the Constitution. The Sixth Amendment protects a defendant to requiring or demanding that a defendant confront a witness against him or her. But this red flag law doesn't do that. In fact, the person making the complaint doesn't even have to physically show up anywhere in any courtroom. The allegation could be made by a telephone call and an affidavit, simply filing a piece of paper. And get this, the person with the guns allegedly doesn't even know the process has started. So no live testimony is required. And then you think about the judges. How many of them are going to have the backbone to say, no, you haven't given me enough information? What kind of judge would want to have it on his or her conscience that he, she, judge didn't listen and something terrible happened, even if the probability is one in a trillion? That's human nature. I'll tell you, I'm a cynical man. It's like Don Corleone talking to the mafia bosses. I'm a cynical man. And I can imagine that the people who were motivated to do this, who inspired this law, who pushed it through, for whom I have only infinite contempt, will encourage people to file petitions and that are intended to be rejected. You follow what I'm saying? Intended to be rejected by the judge. For what purpose? Why would anyone do that? Why would they do that? They will do it to make the case that the judges are reasonable and selective and have, in fact, rejected petitions. Call me cynical? I don't know. You tell me. And so, in a way, this is like, if I may use this analogy, the Jesse Smollett law, because there's no penalty for false reporting. People talk about the unintended consequences of this law. Here's my analysis of that. There are no unintended consequences. Everything is intended. If it is not specifically intended, it is certainly the price that the advocates of this law are willing to pay, or rather, willing to have others pay, to advance a rather totalitarian agenda. And so what's the agenda? If you know that public safety is really not the goal, and it's quite evident that public safety is not the goal, if you know protecting constitutional rights is not the goal, then you have to raise the question, what is the goal? We know, it is reasonable to know, that police will overreact. Once this judge signs an order of confiscation, the police can break into a home at any hour of the day or night, 24 hours. They can break into the home. And the homeowner, or plural homeowners, or a trailer park or a rented unit, an apartment building, will never know. Let that seep in. They will never know. And so you have police breaking in, or sheriffs breaking in, and there are some consequences here that are manifestly obvious to me, infinitely chilling, to think that this United States of America that was founded, that the revolutionary force that created this country was as something as trivial as raising a few pennies on a tax on tea, is now tolerating police to break into homes without any prior notice to the homeowner, again, apartment dwelling owner. And these police are being put into a situation where the probability of violence is very high. The people advancing this agenda are using the police. They are risking the deaths of police. They are willing to risk injuries to police. Unfortunately, all too many police, I fear, will be delighted to play the role. People tend to do what they're told to do, particularly if the person telling them what to do is paying them or is in charge of promoting them. We know the police will overreact, and we know that homeowners may well overreact. In fact, no person who has a firearm in the home or even had one in the past can ever feel secure in the home, because the homeowner, the firearm owner, has no idea that this legal process has begun and has no idea that a judge issued an order. As a practical matter, what are the implications? Well, to me, they're chilling, that self-defense has been eliminated. Every time there's a trial against a police officer for a shooting, almost every time the defenses, I had only one fraction of a second to react. I am trained to react. I had only a fraction of a second. Well, certainly that same theory, that same principle now applies to the homeowner. That homeowner has only a fraction of a second to react. And the homeowner no longer can be sure that a person breaking into his or her home is a criminal, is a thug, is a felon. It could well be the sheriff. It could well be the police. And the homeowner has to assess that in a matter of seconds, a fraction of a second. But these police, these sheriffs are going to be dressed and swatted out as if they were fighting ISIS in Aleppo, as if they were taking on Al-Qaeda in Mosul, instead of some home in a suburban area or a city area. And an error in judgment becomes a death sentence. And all of this, I think, is fully understood, fully anticipated, and orchestrated, where people have put ideology over humanity. And what is that ideology? Well, it's an anti-gun, anti-liberty, anti-individual right belief that people should be subservient to the state, that people should not be able to defend themselves. And I'd take it a step further. I'll take it a step further. This type of legislation is targeted to essentially these white NRA gun-toting, cousin-marrying, tobacco-spitting gun owners. And that's the group that is the target of for elimination by those that are supporting this law. These are not what I've described. They're not the bugs in the legislation. They're not unintended consequences. They are intentional features of intimidation, intentional features of injuring people, likely killing people, for no public benefit. I repeat, for no public benefit. If legislators were truly interested in getting firearms out of the hand or hands of people who were disturbed, who showed inclination of being dangerous to him, her, themselves, or others, there are other ways to do it. And we've seen too many instances where people have exhibited behavior indicating that they were going to cause damage. And authorities did nothing. They ignored it. They overlooked it. They pretended it didn't happen. You can do a Jackie Mason routine on this. They didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want to know. They were tired. It was after work. So the competence level is doubtful. And so where do we go? Where do we go? Well, another aspect then is analyzing the constitutionality of this. And that, I tell you candidly, I'm a lawyer and I practiced criminal law for a long, long time, criminal defense law. And speculating on the constitutionality of anything is a fool's errand. It's silly. You know, you've seen what went on with the hearings regarding Brett Kavanaugh. His view of the Constitution was certainly different from those who maligned him, who attacked him. So what is the Constitution after all? You have people, political office holders, who take an oath to uphold the Constitution. What does that mean? Essentially, it means, I conclude, and I'm sad to share it, I'm sad to believe it, it means nothing. The Constitution can mean whatever anybody wants it to mean. You've seen cases coming out regarding all kinds of things, welfare, immigration, people at the border. The two key United States Supreme Court cases on gun rights, the Heller case and the McDonald case, those were 5-4 decisions. Five justices of the Supreme Court voted in favor of individual rights to own firearms, and four voted against it. That's why these battles for Supreme Court justices are so vicious, so venomous. Ask Mrs. Kavanaugh what it was like to go through that. So I think that the notion of being able to establish that something is or is not constitutional is a crapshoot as to what the judges will do. And the judges are no different from the rest of us. They're just as biased. They're just as political. They're just as emotional. Getting to be a judge is an indicator of skills unrelated to good judgment, wisdom, in terms of things beyond the law. Even in the law, there's questions. I think that one of the great weaknesses of so-called conservatives or classical liberals is placing too much faith in reason, too much faith in good judgment. Because in situations like this, there's a mass psychology that dominates. So what do you think, Mr. Producer? Do you think it's time for a commercial break? I can't believe I've been talking so much. Why don't we take a moment for a commercial break, have one of our sponsors or one or more say a few words, and then we'll continue. Is that all right? Or I can go on.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/AskAuntEmma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/AskAuntEmma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital, starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
This is Karen Cataline, host and producer of Spouting Off. Got an opinion, a guest suggestion, or a show tip? Follow me on Facebook or Twitter and let me know your thoughts. All you need is to know how to spell my name. It's the same on Twitter, Facebook, and www.KarenCataline.com. Karen is spelled the normal way, no goofy Y's or Q's, K-A-R-E-N, and Cataline is spelled K-A-T-A-L-I-N-E. Want more Spouting Off? You can find the complete archive of Spouting Off shows at www.KarenCataline.com. All my op-eds and blog posts are there too. That's www.KarenCataline.com. Thanks for listening, and if you have a moment, please spread the word about Spouting Off.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Michael Sabbath again, hosting for my dear friend, Karen Kathleen. If you've been listening, I hope I have lived up at least to some degree to her skill set and have done some honor for her. And once again, if you have you want to make a call in, chat. The phone number is 888-627-6008. I'm going to change topics dramatically for the balance of the for the hour. I'll share with you some anecdotes. This past weekend, I was in Uvalde, Texas. That's somewhere near San Antonio. I was a guest speaker for a wonderful group, the Texas Hunter Education Instructors Association. And I gave a talk on hunting ethics and hunting rhetoric, that is to say, how to craft arguments to best present hunting and how to refute or deconstruct arguments that were unfair in attacking hunting. And I got into a conversation with two youngsters, about 10, 12 years old, and one instructor, and it had to do about motivating youngsters to act ethically. And something clicked regarding a book I wrote several years ago. And if I may shamelessly plug my own book, I wrote a book titled The Good, the Bad, and the Difference: How to Talk with Children About Values, Michael Sabbath. And it's on Amazon, as you would expect. And I believe it is in a ebook format. And in brief, this book attempts to show parents or anyone dealing with children how to talk about important concepts, how to talk about things that matter. And in families, however you define families, how to create a culture of conversation so that the grown-ups, the mom, the dad, the grandma, grandpa, fill in the blank, is well received by the youngster, by the child, and that there is a trust and an enthusiasm to share, to learn from each other. And I'll tell you a story. This came from a little fifth grader in the Denver area school. I asked the question, what makes you proud? What makes you feel good? And so many of these little kids, fifth graders, what are they, 10, 11 years old? So many of these children said, I feel proud when my mom or dad asks me my opinion. I feel proud when my mom or dad, grandma, grandpa says, what do you think? I value what you think. That gives you some insight into children. And I've come to learn never, ever, ever underestimate the wisdom and the decency of little children. Never underestimate it. I'll tell you a funny story. It was my first year. I'd just gotten out of the hospital. If you get the book, you'll see I wrote this, the ideas for the book were developed lying in a hospital bed after open heart surgery in Porter Hospital in Denver. And my first class, I was just a few weeks into it, and this would have been about March of 1990, seems like 4,000 years ago. I asked the class, why be good? What's in it for you? Why be good? And one little fellow raised his hand. And he said, it just makes life go easier. And then instantly, another little fellow raised his hand and he said, yeah, and then your parents don't have to hire lawyers. And I chuckled and I thought to myself, hiring lawyers, was there ever a profession more misunderstood than mine? Anyway, the theory of the book, the thesis of the book is that there are ways to measure the morality of something, of a belief, of a behavior, of an idea. And I kind of came up with what I call the moral measures, and that's based on some four ethical principles I've selected: autonomy, beneficence, justice, sanctity of life, and then seven competencies, which coincidentally all begin with the letter C. And I came up with this, I think it was my second year, about 2 a.m. I thought it was clever. I made a play on words, sailing the seven seas. And the seas are character and choices, compassion, competence, conscience, consequences, courage. And you can measure that. So why am I mentioning this? I'm going to share one of the most powerful stories, one of the most powerful pieces of content for my classes over the last 10, 15 years. And it has to do, it so coincidentally, in part, involves guns. And this anecdote, it's all true. It's all true. And this is so drenched in lessons to be taught. Here's what happened. It was a bunch of years ago, I don't know, 15, 16, 17. There was a little girl, seventh grader, an honor student in some middle school up in northern Colorado. I won't tell you the name. She came into class carrying her lunchbox, as did all the other children. Came to be lunch period, as it always does. And she opened her lunchbox, and she realized that she had erroneously taken her mother's lunchbox. And in her mother's lunchbox was some cheese and bread and an apple and a butter knife, presumably to cut the cheese and the apple and the bread and so forth. Well, this school had what is called a zero tolerance policy against guns, knives, machine guns, bombers, tanks, and so forth. And this little girl, I want you to see this in your mind's eye. I ask you, please, see this in your mind's eye. This little girl took her lunchbox up to her teacher and said, "Teacher, I made a mistake. I accidentally have my mother's lunchbox. And in my mother's lunchbox is a butter knife. I don't want to get into trouble." And this teacher, in this teacher's infinite wisdom and compassion and judgment, educated at some teacher's college, took that girl down to the principal's office, reported her for violating the zero tolerance policy, and the principal, no doubt also a graduate of some education college, a bureaucrat, no doubt not her first day on the job, suspended this little girl, suspended this honor student for violating a policy that she did without any knowledge or intention. I'm thinking, as I go over this year after year after year, these kinds of educators must hate children. They must despise children. Yet they're teachers and principals. At least these two. There was no compassion. There was no understanding. There was a latent tyrannical impulse where they knew they could hurt this child, and they chose to do that. These people, in my opinion, are beneath contempt. And when I tell the story, and this is only half of it, in my classes to first, second, third, fourth, fifth graders, I can tell you unequivocally in an unalloyed fashion that the students, these youngsters, have contempt for these teachers and they are afraid of them. And they say things like, they don't care about us, they just want to hurt us. That's part one. Here's part two of this story. It was a few years later, in a Denver public school, in an elementary school, could have been a middle school or combined. Anyway, there was this little boy. His name was Lorenzo Hernandez. It's not Irish. Lorenzo Hernandez. Sixth grader, maybe seventh grader. And he and a bunch of his pals are out in the sandbox, the playground, and they're kicking up dirt, throwing a ball around, doing some innocuous thing. When little Lorenzo, kicking up sand in the playground, uncovered a nickel-plated pistol. He picked this up. Now remember, this is a little child, 12 years old maybe. He picked up this pistol and he said, gee, take a look. Looks like a gun. Right away, his friends say, let's see if it works. Let's shoot it. Let's take it home. This is worth a lot of money. I wonder if it works. Is it loaded? Lorenzo had no idea if it's loaded. But he said, no, I'm taking this handgun to the principal. I don't know if it's real. I don't know if it's loaded. But I know it looks like a gun. And it feels like a gun. And he took it to the principal's office. And the principal thanked him profoundly. And in fact, when the press learned, the media learned of this, a special day was held in honor of this little boy at Elitch Gardens, big arcade, a big play center. That's not the word, but I can't think of it. In Denver, downtown Denver. He was honored as a hero, as frankly, well, he should be. Now, here's the question for all of you. Here's the question I grapple with. Here is the question I present to my own little students who were third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. What do you think would have happened if Lorenzo had found that handgun at the Butternut School a week after that little girl was suspended for honestly disclosing that she accidentally had a knife? What would be the motivation? What would be the normal human response? It's obvious. Lorenzo would never have turned that in. No other student would have turned it in because of their distrust for the malice and the malevolence of the teacher, the school principal, and anybody else involved in that school. The Butternut School had destroyed any sense of trust with the students to do something moral, to do something ethical in a challenging situation. If Lorenzo had kept that gun, at what point would he have yielded to the peer group pressure to say, let's see if it works. Let's see if it's loaded. Let me take it home. Let's try to sell it. Let's go into a grocery store and see if we can get all the Cheetos and ding-dongs we want by pointing the gun at somebody. And here's one of the points that just anguish me. They cause anguish in me. We have these horrific shootings at schools. Horrible, horrible things. We had the massacre at Columbine High School. We had the Aurora Theater Schools shooting. We know what happened in Connecticut, Sandy Hook. These are horrible, horrible, vile things. There are evil people out there. And yet people go and they say, how does this happen? Why would people do such a terrible thing? Why would children take a chance with a loaded gun? And here's the answer. It's because of a principal like the one at the Butter Knife School. It's because of the teacher at the Butter Knife School that condemned honesty and decency and morality and punished a decent young child. And so when you see all these at the funerals and the people with the teddy bears and the postcards and the signs, we will never forget you, and on, all these lamentations. You say, how did it happen? This is how it happens, by people like this. And these are lessons that I try to address in my school, in my book, in my lectures. I'll tell you a more uplifting story. This is fun. This is fun. But I hope that you get the point here. I mean, perhaps the sense of despair comes through in my voice, the sense of anger that adults would treat a child this way in such a self-destructive way. And this explains it. But here's something fun. It was one of my classes, it was a third grade class. And I was teaching this wonderful, wonderful statement by Teddy Roosevelt titled, The Battle of Life. The Battle of Life. Google it. It's a beautiful paragraph. And I'll read some of it. It says, in the battle of life, it is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbled, or when the doer of a deed could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who, at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who have tasted neither victory nor defeat. Teddy Roosevelt, The Battle of Life. What a wonderful statement. What a wonderful statement. Well, here's what happened. I finished my class. I was putting my notes away, putting them into the briefcase, perhaps locking the briefcase, a snap or whatever, a strap. And a little boy came up to me. I was only aware that there was one of the students to my left. And he said to me, Dad, I had so many words in my head. I couldn't get them out. But now I know what I wanted to say. He said that what Roosevelt was talking about, he said, it's like courage is like the wood and character is the flame. And the more you add wood, the brighter the flame. Now, this was from a third grade child. Happened to be my own son, Eric. But you can have these conversations with little children, with your children, with your relatives, in-laws, whatever they are. You can have these magical moments. And I hope you do. I hope you do. Maybe my book can help you. That would be lovely. But those were a couple of experiences regarding some of the classes that I taught. I'll tell you one more. And this is particularly timely. Particularly timely, I believe. I was teaching a class, and one student in this magnificent school in Denver, downtown Denver, it's called a magnet school. It's an elementary school. I think it was the finest school I'd been in, and I did this for about 25 years, almost every week for 25 years, not so much lately. And one student, this was a fifth grade class, one student called another student a name. All things considered, it was pretty mild. Nothing racist, sexist, this or that. There was just a name. You brat, you stinker, something like that. As I said, pretty mild this day and age. And the teacher said, don't do that. You hurt her feelings. And I thought, that's an interesting response. That's an interesting analysis. Hurt her feelings. So I had a conversation. I said, well, how much do you really get hurt when someone calls you a name? Even a rough one. You can imagine some rough ones. I'm not going to say them. You know what they are. And the students, like robots, do you understand what I'm telling you? Like robots said, words can hurt. Words can hurt you inside just as much as being hit. Words can damage you. Words are more than hurting feelings. And I said, do you really believe that? Do you really believe that? They said, absolutely. Words can hurt you. I said, let's take a little, do an experiment here. Let us do an experiment. Somebody calls you a name. Pick out the worst name. Pick out the worst name. Someone calls you a name. How are you going to feel? They said, I feel terrible. I feel hurt. I feel offended. I feel violated. They didn't use that word. I said, okay, now here's something else. Somebody comes up to you with a baseball bat and crushes your skull. Which would you rather have, A or B? The bad word or the physical violence? Which would you rather have, A or B? You can't equivocate. You can't rationalize. It's one or the other. And within seconds, I hope I'm saying this clearly. Within seconds, every single one of those students, every one of those fifth graders said, I don't want to get hit. That really hurts. The words really aren't all that bad. You just got to get tough and ignore it. Why should you let just words bother you so much? I don't want to be hit. There's a difference. Words don't cause violence. That wasn't their phrase, but that was their analysis. And I thought about this. I'm standing up there, and I felt so deflated. I felt so dispirited. What went on in that class is representative of. What went on in that class is illustrative of our entire teaching system right now. Everything is feelings and feelings and feelings. We are teaching the children to be weak, and it enrages me. We are teaching children to abandon reason, to abandon judgment. We are teaching children to abandon moral fiber, moral competence. To be strong, to go through life's slings and arrows, as it were. People are going to say terrible things to you. people are going to say terrible things to children. Which is the better response? To decompensate and go to pieces and try to sue everybody and get speech codes that criminalize words? Or to have the attitude, eh, so what? That's the best you can do? Leave me alone, you pathetic lump of protein. Leave me alone. Your words mean nothing to me. You mean nothing to me. I don't care what you call me. It does nothing to me. Which is the better person? Which person would create a better society? Which would create a better culture? The answer is obvious. Anyway, I think I'm looking at my watch. I think I've completed this. I hope that you have found it interesting. My time is up. Mr. Producer is going to interrupt. He's going to interfere. And if my words can be helpful or insightful or inspiring in the slightest way, then I am very pleased. I'm very honored. And again, I thank Karen Cataline for giving me this opportunity to share some thoughts with you. Thank you.